Well, I think the great effort that she's made has been to bring us much more intimately in contact with all the men who lived here.
Before he became a symbol of Camelot, before the Cold War tightened its grip on the globe, before Dallas, John F. Kennedy once described the White House as something far more than a residence. It was, he believed, a living piece of American history, a structure that belonged not to a president, but to the people.
After all, history is a people, and particularly in great moments of our history, presidents. So when we have, as we do today, Grant's table, Lincoln's bed, Monroe's gold set, all these make these men much more alive. So I think it makes the White House a stronger panorama, really, of our great story.
Do you mind living in a house that has as many visitors as this one has?
Well, last year we had the largest in history, which I think shows that the White House is becoming more and more important to American people. Over 1,300,000 people passed through our home. But I'd like to see that number doubled this year. And what is particularly interesting is that at least two-thirds of them were young boys and girls at school. I have always felt that American history is sometimes a dull subject. There's so much emphasis on dates. But I think if they can come here and see alive this building and, in a sense, touch the people who've been here, then they'll go home more interested, and I think that they'll become better Americans. And some of them may want to someday live here themselves, which I think would be very good, even the girls.
The White House sits at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, perhaps the most recognizable home on Earth, a location chosen by George Washington, but first occupied by John Adams in 1800. It was never meant to resemble a palace. Early leaders were careful about that. Even its name evolved slowly, from President's Palace to Executive Mansion, and finally, under Theodore Roosevelt, simply the White House. Not royal, not permanent, borrowed. Built beginning in 1792 and designed by Irish-born architect James Hoban, the structure rose from sandstone and from human contradiction. Skilled craftsmen assembled its Georgian lines, but enslaved laborers carried much of its physical burden. From its earliest foundation, the house reflected the tension at the center of the American experiment. Liberty proclaimed, inequality embedded. Over two centuries, the building has evolved alongside the nation itself. The British burned it during the War of 1812. After its reconstruction, presidents expanded it, reshaped it, modernized it. Offices grew into wings. Terraces became corridors of power. During Harry S. Truman's presidency, engineers discovered the interior was close to collapse. So the entire structure was gutted and reconstructed from within, while its exterior walls stood like a theatrical facade. Stability projected, fragility hidden, history retained. Jackie Kennedy later restored its cultural dignity, turning the mansion into a national showcase of art and history. After the Bay of Pigs, Kennedy ordered construction of the Situation Room, a hardened nerve center for crisis. And beneath the East Wing, during the anxious years of World War II, a bomb shelter was carved into the earth for Franklin D. Roosevelt. Thick concrete, steel ceilings, and emergency communications. A reminder that the presidency is never fully insulated from danger. The White House has always changed. War changed it. Growth changed it. Technology changed it.
Yes, history isn't a guide to the present. In the archives building down Pennsylvania Avenue, there's a stone plaque which says, "What is past is prologue." While it doesn't give us a key to the future, I think it does give us a sense of confidence in the future. This country has passed through very difficult days, but it has passed through them. And it is rather interesting to realize that we're rather an old republic, probably the oldest republic in the world. And when we were founded, there was a king in France, a czar in Russia, an emperor in Peking. All that's been wiped away, and yet this country continues. So that makes us feel that we'll continue in the future, and that we represent a long effort building on the lives of the men and the efforts of the men who were here and of the American people in the past. So I consider history to be a source of, our history to be a source of strength to us here in the White House and to all the American people. And anything which dramatizes the great story of the United States, as I think the White House does, is worthy of the closest attention and respect by Americans who live here and who visit here and who are part of our citizenry. And that's why I'm glad that Jackie is making the effort she's making. And I know other first ladies have done it, and I know that those who come after us will continue to try to make this the center, really, of a sense of American historical life.
In October 2025, with little public warning, demolition crews began tearing down the East Wing. Heavy machinery clawed through one of the most symbolic public sections of the building. Change isn't abnormal, but historians were caught off guard. Architects were stunned. Even preservationists struggled to understand how such a dramatic alteration, without need, could unfold without meaningful public discussion. As rubble piled up, Donald Trump offered a simple explanation. The project would cost hundreds of millions, funded by, quote, me and some friends. The East Wing housed offices for the First Lady, social staff, correspondence teams, and served as a primary public entrance. Visitors passed through it on their way into what Americans often call, quote, the People's House. Its removal felt less like renovation and more like subtraction. Officially, the project focuses on building a lavish 90,000 square foot ballroom, a structure large enough to rival and potentially overshadow the existing White House residence. The symbolism is striking and unmistakable. The people's entrance removed for a gilded ballroom. Democracy out, aristocracy in. And the ballroom's scale introduces a visual imbalance that would drive most designers insane. Much like Robert Moses's strategy of building first and forcing adaptation later, the project's aggressive scope raises a question. Is this simply an addition or the opening move toward a far larger redesign of the entire complex? Less discussed was what lay below. Upgrades to the underground emergency bunker, now known as the Presidential Emergency Operations Center, overseen in part by military and Secret Service planners. A preservation group filed suit. The administration responded that halting construction could endanger national security. But this scope doesn't sound like someone preparing to leave. Technically, the White House exists in a legal gray zone. Federal preservation laws that govern most historic buildings do not apply here. Local permitting agencies have no jurisdiction. It is considered a living building, free to evolve with the presidency. But legality and legitimacy are not the same thing, because this was never just about architecture. It was about posture. In a letter written the night after moving in, John Adams wrote to his wife,
"I pray heaven bestow the best of blessings on this house and all that shall hereafter inhabit it. May none but honest and wise men ever rule under this roof."
For most of American history, the idea that a president might treat the White House as personal property, reshape it unilaterally, imprint it with private wealth, would have been unthinkable. Yet the demolition unfolded with the confidence of someone accustomed to building first and explaining later. Trump, after all, built his career in real estate, a world where leverage is currency and scale signals dominance. Courts found him liable for falsifying business records tied to payments and property valuations, inflating and deflating them to secure financial advantage. His explanation was characteristically blunt. Everyone does it. Some elites echoed the sentiment. others warned that holding such behavior accountable might drive wealth away. Notice the pattern. When wealth concentrates, it doesn't just accumulate. It begins to bend the rules meant to govern everyone else. The guardrails designed to preserve fairness start to look negotiable. Equal opportunity becomes less a shared promise and more a conditional privilege. And when those at the top redefine the boundaries of accountability, the standard doesn't stay contained. It cascades downward, reshaping expectations across institutions. This is the moral climate forming above us, a quiet recalibration of what is tolerated and what is not. Because when power can redraw the lines without consequence, the Constitution stops functioning as a fixed compass and starts behaving more like a suggestion. Now let's be clear, the White House is not sacred. It was constructed in part by enslaved people. For decades, enslaved servants maintained its operations. Reverence without memory is just myth-making. But process matters. Consensus matters. Because the White House has also always symbolized a fragile agreement. The president lives there temporarily, only as long as the public allows.
This house will always grow and should. It just seemed to me such a shame when we came here to find hardly anything of the past in the house, hardly anything before 1902.
This is Jackie Kennedy during a televised tour of the White House in 1962. She explained her thought process and approach in turning the mansion into a national showcase of art and history.
I know when we went to Columbia, the presidential palace there has all the history of that country in it, where Simon Bolivar was, every piece of furniture in it has some link with the past. I thought the White House should be like that.
Well, now, can you make these changes according to your own personal tastes and desires?
Well, no, I have a committee which has museum experts and government people and private citizens on it. And then everything we do is subject to approval by the Fine Arts Committee.
What's your budget? Where does it come from?
Well, it's small because everything we do is by private donation. And every time we find an object we want, then we have to go and search for a donor. It's very slow, and that way a lot of things that we would like to get slip away from us.
Now, suppose that you and your committee were to acquire some of the things that are in this room. What happens when the next president's wife comes into the White House?
Well, if they don't want it, in the past, you see, they could sell it, throw it out, do anything with it they wanted. But then a law was passed last spring, which we asked to have passed, whereby everything that's given to or bought by the White House becomes part of its permanent collection. If a future First Family doesn't want it, it goes to the Smithsonian, where it will be taken care of and displayed.
To dramatically alter the White House without broad public input doesn't just change a building, it reframes ownership. And Donald Trump and his actions here are not an anomaly. He is an amplification, the personification of an era. Like the one who took too much meat by the fire, he reflects a growing posture among powerful elites, a willingness to disregard the group in pursuit of private desire. Trump is simply the loudest expression of a mindset gaining traction across modern power structures, one that sees institutions less as shared inheritances and more as assets waiting to be repositioned by influence or by force. And it doesn't stop with the visible theater of politics. Behind the stage operates a new generation of networks most Americans rarely hear about. One of them is the Rockbridge Network, founded in 2019 by J.D. Vance and media figure, writer, and venture capitalist Chris Buskirk. Think of it less as a donor circle and more as political venture capital, investing not only in candidates, but in media platforms, legal campaigns, grassroots mobilization, and even blueprints for a future, quote, government in waiting. Its membership reportedly includes wealthy investors from Silicon Valley and Wall Street, among them Peter Thiel, Rebecca Mercer, and the Winklevoss twins. by 2024, the network had grown to roughly 150 members and assembled a $75 million war chest aimed at reshaping the country's ideological trajectory. Much of this activity flows through nonprofits and donor-advised funds, structures that can obscure the movement of money. Supporters call it a strategic coordination. Critics call it shadow governance. Either way, it signals something deeper, power increasingly organizing itself beyond public view. But history reminds us that government, imperfect as it has always been, was never meant to function like a corporation. At its best, it is directed by the people and accountable to the collective good. Capitalism can generate extraordinary prosperity, but when left entirely unchecked, it can concentrate power so tightly that democracy struggles to breathe. Scarcity is not a natural law. It is often a policy choice, a decision tree. And decisions can be remade. When markets fail to provide the basics, water, food, shelter, governance exists to close the gap, not widen it. The demolition of the East Wing might seem like a small story, just another renovation in a house that has survived fires, wars, and centuries of reinvention. But symbols matter, because when the symbol of democracy begins to look like the private estate of an aristocrat, when public space starts to feel privately negotiated, and when wealth speaks louder than process, you have to ask what else is being redesigned, whether the system still belongs to all of us. Here's the deeper twist. We may have inherited rules built to protect yesterday's winners, but they are not inevitable. Balance in any society is never self-executing. It must be insisted upon. Apathy, self-censorship, and quiet obedience creates space for those willing to take more than their share. Actors who step beyond norms precisely because no one stops them. But leveling has always been the forgotten act of democracy. Sometimes it looks like jokes. Sometimes protest. Sometimes it looks like organizing. Sometimes it is as simple and as powerful as a ballot. But it always begins with refusing to look away. The same way past generations reshaped communities, sometimes disastrously, we still hold the power to reshape them with intention, together. I'm Demetrius Lynch, and this is Built to Divide.
In our day, certain economic truths have become accepted as self-evident. A second Bill of Rights, under which a new basis of security and prosperity can be established for all, regardless of station or race or creed.
In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
Over the last couple of episodes, we examined how crisis, chaos, and division reshape ownership and illuminated the motivating factors behind that division: faith, technology, and finance. Reading the tea leaves to ask, what happens when fear, chaos, and division becomes the foundation of governance? If you haven't listened to those episodes, I encourage you to go back and listen to all of the episodes of this series in order. And if you've enjoyed and learned something from this series, I really hope you'll not just share it, but actively get one person to listen, because I strongly feel this information is critical for everyone to hear if we're going to move forward as a united and better society. This final chapter clears away the myths that keep the housing crisis misunderstood. It examines the real forces driving unaffordability, restricted supply, financialization, policy choices, and political incentives, and shows how housing evolved from shelter into a vehicle for wealth extraction. But this is not just diagnosis, it is direction. The episode lays out a practical path forward: legalizing more homes where life happens, streamlining approvals, placing guardrails on speculation, stabilizing vulnerable households, and redesigning communities to foster connection instead of isolation. And we'll get into all of that after this break. Episode 12, We're Not Done. In July of 2001, I stepped into the field wearing a bright yellow safety vest that felt two sizes too big and carrying a responsibility far larger than I understood at the time. I was an intern at the Public Works Department in the city of Compton. I organized plans and sat in on meetings, but most mornings I rode shotgun in a city truck, rolling slowly through neighborhoods, scanning for cracked sidewalks, potholes, collapsing fences, and illegal additions. The quiet signals of a community either being cared for or neglected. On paper, our job was simple. Identify violations, document them, follow up. But what I was really learning, though I didn't yet have the language for it, was this. The built environment tells the truth about power, because the built environment doesn't lie. I grew up in and around communities where investment was scarce, where neglect showed itself in broken infrastructure, underfunded schools, and public spaces that felt forgotten. But I've also walked through neighborhoods, both here and abroad, built to endure. Places with strong schools, maintained streets, and assets designed to give the next generation a head start instead of a setback. You don't need a report to see the difference. You can feel it. Because the built environment is more than concrete and steel. It's a record of priorities. It shows who is protected, who's worth investing in, and who has been quietly left behind. That summer was the beginning of a journey that carried me through studios and job sites, through sleepless nights in architecture school, and through moments that tested whether I belonged at all. Like the night I accidentally drove an X-Acto blade into my leg at 3 a.m. while finishing a model, only to limp into a crit hours later and have my work torn apart anyway. Architecture school doesn't just train you, it dismantles you first. The ridicule could be brutal. The expectations, relentless. And as a Black man entering a profession where less than 2% of licensed architects looked like me, there were moments where the isolation felt structural, almost as if it had been designed that way. But I stayed. Over the years, I practiced across building types, specialty retail, creative offices, restaurants, medical facilities, hospitality, and above all, housing. I stood beside tradespeople in the field, sat with executives in boardrooms, navigated the space between vision and feasibility. I saw the industry from nearly every angle, and through almost my entire career, one issue has echoed louder than all the others: housing affordability. At first, it was a concern, then a trend, then a crisis. Today, it is the defining spatial challenge of our time. I've heard every explanation imaginable for why housing has become so expensive. We're out of land. Foreign buyers are taking everything. Interest rates are killing us. Short-term rentals are hollowing neighborhoods. Investors are hoarding homes. Rent control scares builders away. Each story arrives neatly packaged, emotionally satisfying, politically convenient. But tidy explanations are often the most dangerous, because they stop us from asking harder questions and having difficult conversations. So let's begin with the simple truth of housing. Land typically accounts for about 20 to 25% of the total cost of building a home. That number shifts depending on location, access, and demand, because land, unlike lumber or concrete, isn't manufactured. Its value is shaped by economic conditions, interest rates, infrastructure, and the simple reality of who wants to live there. But here's the critical distinction. We are not out of land. We are out of permissions. And no, this is not a call to build on protected landscapes. It is a recognition that roughly 75% of residential land in American cities is zoned exclusively for single-family detached homes. In some cities, that number climbs as high as 94%. When the rules say only one, the market answers only the wealthy. Housing scarcity is rarely natural. More often, it is designed, written into policy, reinforced through zoning, and protected in the name of neighborhood character. desirable areas become carefully guarded spaces. If we want fewer bidding wars, we need more homes in the places people actually live their lives, near jobs, transit, schools, and care networks. Duplexes, triplexes, fourplexes, accessory dwelling units, small apartments along transit corridors. And we desperately need to reconsider parking requirements. When approvals are predictable, less cumbersome, and projects can move forward by right, risk becomes calculable. Neighbors can better understand what's coming, and housing that should exist actually gets built. Now, some point to pre-construction costs, permits, development fees, design, as major drivers of housing prices. Building permits generally range from 0.5 to 2% of construction costs. Design fees often fall between 10 and 20%. But design is not excess. Good design reduces uncertainty, prevents costly mistakes, and limits waste long before construction begins. Permit and development fees serve a purpose as well. They fund inspections, enforce safety standards, and help municipalities expand infrastructure, streets, utilities, emergency services needed to support growth. Remember, in many property tax-capped jurisdictions, these fees have become a fiscal patch, helping cities close budget gaps created by decades of revenue limitations. Revisiting property tax structure may be a worthy effort to ease development costs. But in other words, these costs are rarely arbitrary. They are the price of building safely, responsibly, and within a functioning civic system. Now, many point to construction costs. I've heard, we'll say, more seasoned professionals blame rising housing costs on building codes, especially energy codes. Each new cycle adds requirements that can increase construction costs anywhere from a few hundred dollars to tens of thousands per building. But those mandates aren't arbitrary. They improve life safety, health, and overall comfort while lowering long-term expenses. Since the 1990s, energy-efficient buildings have reduced operating costs significantly, saving roughly 60 cents per square foot on maintenance, 50 cents on janitorial services, and 53 cents on utilities each year. In other words, while upfront costs may rise, the long-term financial and human benefits often outweigh the initial investment. Yes, materials are expensive. Labor costs have risen, inflation has reshaped the value of the dollar, but zoom out and the picture shifts. Since the 1940s, the dollar has lost roughly 96% of its purchasing power. Wages, in many cases, haven't kept up the same pace. Nearly everything costs more, not just housing. Yet builder profits have remained relatively stable over time, dipping mainly during economic downturns. In fact, recent data shows margins improving. By 2023, single-family builders reported their highest net profit margin in over 30 years at 8.7%, second only to the 10% peak in 1991. Gross margins also climbed from 18.2% in 2020 to 20.7% in 2023, while net margins rose from 7% to 8.7%. These numbers suggest that despite rising construction costs, profitability has not eroded, and in some cases has strengthened, challenging the idea that the builder margins are the primary driver of housing affordability issues. So while overall costs have increased, it has been relatively marginal. Construction expenses alone are not the defining force here. There's a much bigger engine at work. Interest rates are often blamed next. And they do matter. When rates rise, monthly payments surge. But the shortage predates the latest rate cycle. After the Great Recession, fear of overbuilding hardened into policy and practice. We stopped producing enough homes and never caught up. Vacancies fell to historic lows. Then rates collapsed. When mortgage rates dropped below 3%, buyers suddenly gained enormous purchasing power. Demand surged. Prices responded exactly as economics predicts. They exploded. Rates are the accelerant. scarcity is the fuel. But if we argue only about rates, we're debating pain relief while ignoring the disease. Now, what about investors? Here, the conversation gets warmer, but still incomplete. Foreign buyers can reshape a skyline, but nationally, they account for a small share of transactions. Short-term rentals tighten tourist-heavy markets, but they are side currents, not the tide. Institutional investors matter locally, especially where supply is thin, but scarcity is what gives speculation its leverage. When you ration a good, every bidder looks like the villain. Fix the rationing, and the villain loses their script. Even the claim that luxury housing doesn't help misunderstands the mechanics. New units enter at the top of the market, and over time, older units filter down as they age. It isn't magic, it's math. But math alone cannot explain what happened to housing in America. For that, we have to zoom out. Because the truth is, housing is no longer just shelter. It is an asset class. And that transformation, the financialization of housing, is the gravitational force shaping everything we see.
The economic ills we suffer have come upon us over several decades. They will not go away in days, weeks, or months, but they will go away. They will go away because we, as Americans, have the capacity now, as we've had in the past, to do whatever needs to be done to preserve this last and greatest bastion of freedom. In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
Since the late 20th century, the United States untethered mortgage credit from its old constraints. Adjustable rate mortgages, mortgage-backed securities, subprime lending, financial deregulation, the repeal of Glass-Steagall. Each innovation expanded the flow of credit. More borrowing created more demand. More demand collided with restricted supply. Prices rose. This is the modern housing story. Not a gold rush, but a credit rush. Cheap money met scarce homes. The outcome was inevitable. Then came 2021, the perfect storm. Record low interest rates, pandemic-driven demand for space, material shortages, labor constraints, decades of underbuilding, investors purchasing 1 in 5 homes in some markets. Every pressure point converged. The spike that followed became one of the largest in American history. Across continents and history, the pattern repeats. An accelerant, jobs, migration, cheap credit, a constraint, restrictive zoning, slow approvals, financialization, homes treated as yield, policy amplification, incentives here, barriers there. That quartet writes the price. And if you can name a pattern, you can change it. But here is the even harder truth, the one the building industry rarely wants to confront. We cannot design our way out of this crisis. We cannot build fast enough to outrun a financial system that treats housing primarily as a vehicle for wealth accumulation. This is bigger than architecture, bigger than construction. Housing is not just a design problem. It's a political one.
One of the things Scott said, though, is, again, existing housing, people that own their homes, we're going to keep them wealthy. We're going to keep those prices up. We're not going to destroy the value of their homes so that somebody that didn't work very hard can buy a home. We're going to make it easier to buy. We're going to get interest rates down. But I want to protect the people that for the first time in their lives feel good about themselves. They feel like they've, you know, that they're wealthy people. And I want them to understand it. You know, there's so much talk about, oh, we're going to drive housing prices down. I don't want to drive housing prices down. I want to drive housing prices up for people that own their homes. And they can be assured that's what's going to happen.
You can see the influence of the ruling class over time. The very industry tasked with building America historically votes for policies that undermine its own long-term stability, trading structural health for perceived gains, which are short-term at best. As we've discussed, since the 1970s, most economic gains have gone to ownership. Elections shape infrastructure spending, labor law, taxation, environmental regulation, the entire operating environment for construction. Meanwhile, union membership, once a source of immense collective leverage, has collapsed. In 1973, roughly 60% of construction workers were non-union. Today, nearly 90% are. That's not just a statistic. That is a shift in power. The design profession hasn't had a meaningful union historically. Low wages, extreme hours, and a culture of silent endurance became normalized. A race to the bottom disguised as passion.
The workers united will never be defeated. The workers united will never be defeated.
Recent protests outside Bjerk Engels Group's London office reveal what happens when a largely non-unionized profession faces sudden instability. After a major project was canceled, the firm considered cutting up to 72 roles, possibly more, sparking demonstrations from workers and unions demanding fair severance and transparency. Many affected architects were foreign employees with visas tied to their jobs, amplifying fear and vulnerability. Protests called the moment a warning for the entire industry, highlighting architecture's persistent hire and fire culture and the limited collective power of its workforce. Evidence that without stronger labor organizations, even elite firms can leave professionals exposed. Divide and conquer has always been the oldest management strategy. And too often, it still works. That power struggle could influence how we vote. Now consider taxes. Corporate cuts are often framed as catalysts for investment. Yet historically, those savings flow towards shareholders, stock buybacks, and lobbying. Not innovation, not workers. Deregulation promises efficiency, but frequently delivers unsafe jobs, lower quality construction, and environmental harm. Meanwhile, sustainability, one of the fastest growing sectors in construction, hinges on political outcomes that determine whether green energy expands or stalls. Every election redraws the construction landscape. The industry is not separate from politics, it is downstream from it. But even policy debates miss something deeper. Housing is not just an economic system, it is a social machine. Over the past century, American housing quietly perfected the art of separation. We traded porches for bonus rooms, connectivity for cul-de-sacs, shared stoops for private gates. Our homes grew larger and our lives grew smaller. We stopped seeing one another, and loneliness is not merely emotional. Research shows social isolation increases susceptibility to radicalization. When you rarely encounter your neighbor, it becomes easier to fear them, blame them, dehumanize them. When public space shrinks, private anxiety expands, and the architecture of division becomes the architecture of distrust. Places that invite incidental contact, short blocks, front doors facing each other, pocket parks, generate social capital, trust, familiarity, soft oversight. Jane Jacobs called it eyes on the street. So if we built division into the landscape, we can build connection back in.
In our day, certain economic truths have become accepted as self-evident. A second Bill of Rights, under which a new basis of security and prosperity can be established for all, regardless of station or race or creed. Among these are the right to a useful and remunerative job, the right to earn enough to provide adequate food and clothing and recreation, the right of every farmer to raise and sell his products at a return which will give him and his family a decent living, the right of every businessman, large and small, to trade in an atmosphere of freedom. Freedom from unfair competition and domination by monopolies at home or abroad. The right of every family to a decent home. the right to adequate medical care, and the opportunity to achieve and enjoy good health, the right to adequate protection from the economic fears of old age, sickness, accident, and unemployment, the right to a good education. All of these rights spell security. And after this war is won, we must be prepared to move forward in the implementation of these rights to new goals of human happiness and well-being. For unless there is security here at home, there cannot be lasting peace in the world.
Imagine a typical residential block. A corner lot becomes a fourplex that looks like a large house. Pitched roof, welcoming porch. A bungalow adds an ADU for a retiree. A vacant teardown becomes a duplex. The old corner store reopens with apartments above. Suddenly, a teacher, a nurse, a student, and a widower share the same street. School enrollment stabilizes. The cafe anchors daily rituals. Children play on stoops. Growth didn't arrive as a costly tower. It arrived as a natural rhythm. Not utopia, but intention. A century ago, Americans were wary of debt. Then the late 20th century taught us to embrace it. Credit cards, student loans, home equity extraction. For many, debt was a ladder. For many others, it was a trap. Between 2000 and 2007, Americans withdrew home equity for consumption on a scale comparable to a medium-sized nation's GDP. Then came the crash. Borrowers slipped, lenders sued, neighborhoods hollowed. Debt is not the villain. Most families cannot buy without it. But we must stop designing a system where opportunity for some becomes exposure for others. We need ladders with rails, not trampolines over a canyon. Shared equity models, credit systems that recognize rent history, counseling that protects first-time buyers, safeguards against predatory products. I recently had a conversation with Zachary Faust, a Delaware realtor and content creator who proposed the idea of first-time homebuyer fund and investor ladder.
A, on the legislative side, we need to create simultaneously a first-time homebuyer fund and an investor ladder. What that is a fund that is created specifically and houses money only for funds for first-time homebuyers to either buy down their rates to be more competitive or use toward closing costs and down payment assistance. Most people need one or the other. A lot of people need help on the payment side. And if we lower rates, again, we're lowering them for everybody. So I think there needs to be something in place to where we can give some advantage to the first-time buyer. We fund it. So everyone's like, where's the money come from? With a investor ladder. Simply put, if you purchase a property with plans to profit, flip, invest, Airbnb, whatever, you're going to pay a 2 to 3% fee at the closing table that will go up as you invest more. It will simultaneously create a world where less people will invest when they have a lot more. And yes, you could create a corporate veil, an LLC, and blah, 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 blah. I think this would all come with, you need to fix that problem a little bit. But you're also going to create a world where minimum 2 to 3% comes out of every single time. You're going to quell a little bit of the demand there, a little bit less purchase because they're going to have to incur that fee. Also, could come off the purchase price because now investors are very money focused. They maybe say, hey, I have to pay this fee. I'm going to take it off the purchase price. That could happen. But you're ultimately going to create a take a home, make a home symbiotic relationship of if one home comes off the market for profit, there's another opportunity for a first time home buyer to purchase.
Housing should build stability, not fragility. And while long-term reforms take shape, we need immediate protections. Eviction diversion, rental assistance, property tax relief, just for seniors. Nets are not ladders, but nets save lives while ladders are being built. We must also domesticate investment, not demonize it, but aim it toward building rather than hoarding. Cities can partner with private investment to deliver housing at scale, with limited contracts to return housing to the public. Development of a build-to-rent community with an off-ramp that converts to a rent-to-own after 10 to 20 years. Ultimately, the future of housing will be shaped by whether we remember a simple principle, scarcity is not a natural law. It is a decision tree. The same hands that wrote today's rules can write better ones. Legalize more homes where opportunity exists. Fund homes where need is greatest. And measure success not by rising prices, but by how many neighbors can live well. In our very first episode, we gathered around a campfire, a hunter boasting, an elder teasing, a community using story to keep the circle fit. Somewhere along the way, our rules flipped. We began praising portfolios more than people. We walled off land with codes. We turned the home, a human necessity, into a competitive sport. But the circle doesn't have to close.
We also know that no matter how dynamically the economy develops and expands, it does not eliminate all poverty. The problem indicates that our emphasis must be twofold. We must create full employment, or we must create incomes. People must be made consumers by one method or the other. Once they are placed in this position, we need to be concerned that the potential of the individual is not wasted. New forms of work that enhance the social good will have to be devised for those for whom traditional jobs are not available. In 1879, Henry George anticipated this state of affairs when he wrote in Progress and Poverty, "The fact is that the work which improves the condition of mankind, the work which extends knowledge and increases power and enriches literature and elevates thought, is not done to secure living. It is not the work of slaves driven to that task, either by the task of that of a taskmaster or by animal necessities. It is the work of men who somehow find a form of work that brings a security for its own sake. In a state of society where want is abolished, work of this sort could be enormously increased. And we are likely to find that the problem of housing, education, instead of preceding the elimination of poverty, will themselves be affected if poverty is first abolished. The poor transformed into purchasers will do a great deal on their own to alter housing decay. Negroes who have a double disability will have a greater effect on discrimination when they have the additional weapon of cash to use in their struggle. Beyond these advantages, a host of positive psychological changes inevitably will result from widespread economic security. The dignity of the individual will flourish when the decisions concerning his life are in his own hands, when he has the assurance that his income is stable and certain, and when he knows that he has the means to seek self-improvement. Personal conflicts between husband, wife, and children will diminish when the unjust measurement of human worth on a scale of dollars is eliminated."
Thank you for walking this maze with me. If this season gave you new insights, share them. If it gave you an idea, use it. And when someone tells you housing must be expensive, remember the evidence. Find a new solution and contribute to the movement. Because we're not done building. Not homes, not communities, not the future. Thanks for listening. Built to Divide is presented by Lines, my architecture and creative studio. This podcast is produced in collaboration with Gable Media. If you enjoyed the show, please tell a friend and rate and review it on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. It really helps others find it. And if you're looking for similar content, Built to Divide is part of the Gable Media Network, where you can find even more like this. Visit GableMedia.com. That's GABLmedia.com. And before I go, if you want to see additional photos, video clips, and content that went into this episode, You can visit me at lines.studio/podcasts. Talk soon.